Pyongyang throws a tantrum today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. North Korea cancels a meeting with South Korea and threatens to pull out of the planned summit with President Trump. The White House says it expected that, and over in Seoul, they're not too worried.
South Korea and North Korea have been down this path many times before.
Plus, what Kellogg's exit from Venezuela says about the situation there.
Seeing Kellogg pull out of the country is another reminder of the extreme economic downfall that the country is going through. It's also a reminder of the food shortages that are very rampant in Venezuela due to these economic problems.
Those stories and a whole lot more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being with us today. No one said it was going to be easy or even be at all. North Korea's thrown some cold water on the planned Kim Jong-un-Donald Trump summit. First, Pyongyang canceled a meeting with South Korea that had been slated for today. North Korea's official news agency said the move was because long-planned U.S.-South Korean military exercises were going ahead. Then later, North Korea stated simply that it would not give up its nuclear weapons and would cancel the planned summit with Donald Trump if the U.S. continued to insist on denuclearization. And today, Trump did insist again. But the White House also says it's not giving up on the planned negotiations. For their part, South Koreans appear to be taking it mostly in stride. Reporter Jason Strother is in Seoul.
It's probably not a big surprise to many South Koreans that there would be some hiccups along the road, but South Korea and North Korea have been down this path many times before, and there's no reason to expect that today's decision to call off the high-level talks or make these threats to reconsider the Trump-Kim summit is actually the end of the road.
Yeah, so, I mean, the mood seemed pretty joyous a couple of weeks ago when Moon Jae-in met Kim Jong-un at the DMZ. So do you think South Koreans just kind of always sheltered a little doubt that Kim Jong-un was ever going to unilaterally give up North Korea's nukes?
I still don't think South Koreans really believe that Kim Jong-un is actually going to give up his nuclear weapons. I think what they're hoping more for is a sort of detente that by engaging in negotiations and dialogue, that this could at least, you know, lead to a de-escalation of tensions, that we won't see the kinds of threats and hostilities that were traded back and forth last year between Pyongyang and Washington take place again. I think South Koreans would be plenty happy just to not have to worry about threats of Seoul being turned into a sea of fire, perhaps.
I mean, I got to say, that seems diametrically opposed to the view of the Trump administration and its supporters of the last week that Kim would actually give up all those weapons. How did South Koreans view that euphoria in Washington?
I think South Koreans are still trying to figure out what exactly President Trump is all about. He does have fairly high approval ratings here. Some people do credit him with bringing Kim Jong-un to the negotiating table. But I do feel there is perhaps a sense that maybe Washington, the Trump administration, is perhaps naive that it could come to the Korean Peninsula, demand North Korea give up its nuclear weapons and make no concessions of its own. I mean, in fact, this is precisely why North Korea has thrown this tantrum today. It sees the Trump administration as pressuring the regime to give up its arms unilaterally, and no word of what the U.S. might do in return for North Korea dismantling its nuclear weapons program.
So with Kim now basically saying, we're not giving up all our nukes, are you hearing any dire warnings from people who believe this puts the world back on a track to war?
The pessimists haven't really voiced those concerns yet. I don't think anyone believes that today's developments means the end of the line for negotiations between South and North Korea, or for that matter, North Korea and the U.S. But what it does mean is perhaps that the Trump administration needs to choose its words a little more carefully. I mean, for instance, National Security Advisor John Bolton said recently that he would like to see a Libyan-style denuclearization process for North Korea. I think we all know what happened to Colonel Gaddafi. He was pressured to give up his nukes over a decade ago, and Western allies helped overthrow him.
Yeah, and Libya and Iraq were cited in the statement from Pyongyang that we don't want to be turned into that. And actually, they kind of communicated a sense of being really insulted that this would even be our fate.
North Korea is often called the most isolated country in the world, the Hermit Kingdom, but it's not ignorant to what has gone on beyond its borders. It knows that it does not want to follow in the footsteps of Muammar Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein. That's why many North Korea observers think it's highly unlikely that the regime would really ever denuclearize.
So, Jason, what are South Koreans hoping for at this point? If not full denuclearization of North Korea, what do they want?
South Koreans just want to have a normal life here. And I think coming out of the summit, where there were many lofty goals pledged by President Moon and ruler Kim to completely rid the peninsula of nuclear weapons, to work toward a peace treaty, that's all fine and good. But I mean, one thing that I hear from South Koreans that they're really excited about is the potential to link South Korea's train lines with North Korea's train lines, so people can get on a train at Seoul Station and ride all the way to London someday.
Wow. I'm looking at the map right now. That had never occurred to me. And it also is
that'd be a long ride.
Yeah, it'd be a long ride, but it's also a really sharp illustration of how isolated South Korea is. I mean, we think of North Korea as a hermit kingdom, but South Korea is this appendage at the bottom of the Korean Peninsula. And you're right. They can't get out of there unless it's by plane or boat.
Many South Koreans say they are a de facto island. They're at the bottom of a peninsula and there is no overland transport through the northern half of the peninsula. So they feel that by linking train lines, let's say, they would be more connected to the rest of the world.
Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
And we'll be coming back to the Korean Peninsula later in the show with an in-depth look at North Korea's army of hackers.
They have amassed some of the most elite hacking units in the world. They've put a lot of energy and time into robbing banks, hacking banks online and stealing millions of dollars.
And not just any bank. North Korea is believed to have ripped off the Federal Reserve Bank of New York back in 2016. That's coming up later here on The World. In Baghdad, you'll find the sprawling neighborhood of Sadr City. In the years after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq that toppled Saddam Hussein, a young Shia cleric emerged from that neighborhood and started gaining influence. Muqtada al-Sadr, you probably remember that name, he assembled a militia that fought both the U.S. military and Sunni extremists in Iraq. His fighters gained a reputation for brutal violence. In 2006, Newsweek called him the most dangerous man in Iraq. Now, more than a decade later, Muqtada al-Sadr has renounced religious sectarianism and turned to politics. With the ballots still being counted from recent parliamentary elections, his coalition holds a commanding lead. Thanasi Kambanis is a journalist and fellow at the Century Foundation. He joins us from Beirut. Thanasi, before Muqtada al-Sadr became this figure rallying against corruption in Iraq, he was a militia leader. So tell us a little bit about the appeal he had in those early days after the fall of Saddam Hussein.
So he's a hereditary family leader. He's a very junior cleric himself, but his father and his uncle were some of the most impressive and important Shia clerics in not only Iraqi history, but in the entire Middle Eastern pantheon of Islamists. So he inherited this large organization and a following many millions of people strong when he burst onto the scene in 2003. He wasn't even 30 years old when the United States invaded Iraq. And almost instantly, he emerged as the most important dissenter or critic of the Americans. And he very quickly went from being a critic to being the most formidable armed resistance to the United States. His militia, the Mahdi militia, rose up in 2004. It caused huge headaches for the U.S. And fast forward years later, Muqtada al-Sadr's militia was still fighting in civil wars with its own Shia rivals. So he's been a thorn in the side of many different players in Iraq, going back to Saddam Hussein and then all the way up to today's leaders.
So in 2004, when he was assembling the Mahdi army, how did Iraqis view him and when did that view of him change?
Well, so there's sort of two threads to Muqtada's reputation. One, sort of an appealing nationalism. When he first rose up against the Americans, he had a sort of cross-sectarian appeal and joined forces with some of the Sunni militants, even though he comes from a storied Shia clerical family. The other side, of course, is that of a man who would stop at nothing for power and who possessed millions of followers who will obey his commands simply because of who he is, rather than the positions he's taken. That is the side of Muqtada that has made a lot of people nervous about him. When he organized his militia in the first place, people saw it as a real death blow to the ability of the Iraqi state to function as a unitary authority. Later on, he undermined other Shia politicians who were trying to govern the country from Baghdad. And so today, many Iraqis who are familiar with some of the corruption and sectarian violence that his militias and allies have engaged in just don't trust what he says about now being a nationalist reformer and someone who just wants to lead Iraq to a better place.
How did the arrival of ISIS on the scene in Iraq in 2014 kind of change his fortunes? I mean, it became the focus of Iraqi politics. Did that affect Muqtada al-Sadr in any way?
He reformed his militia, which had been temporarily disbanded, and he has played the war against ISIS very shrewdly. So his sectarianization and corruption have been somewhat laundered by the sacrifices his fighters made against ISIS. And at the same time, he has positioned himself as a loyal nationalist patriot in contrast to his political competitors.
It's the new and improved Muqtada al-Sadr. He's now the front runner in the Iraqi parliamentary elections. Politically, what are his plans to shake up the system?
Well, so this is where we get to the important caveats. One is that we have to see whether, when push comes to shove, he's really going to stick to this reform agenda. The most interesting promise he's made is that if he can't actually lead a technocratic government, he will choose to go into opposition. Iraq has not had any actual political opposition since 2003 because every party has preferred to be part of the feeding frenzy of corruption rather than serving as opposition. So if Muqtada finds that he can't get his wish, which is very likely, will he stick to his guns, give up the opportunities for patronage, wealth, control, jobs, and other goodies? If he does that, his long-term influence will be great, and the move could do a lot to save Iraq from itself.
Assuming he does not build the coalition he needs to implement his plans, what would Muqtada al-Sadr mean for Iraq, playing that scenario out?
Well, if he's the leader of a real opposition to the government, I think he will become the symbol of all the unrealized hopes for Iraq. In a way, that's already what he did with this election. Even though he's been part of the system, he sold himself as the person who's a pure, true independent. And it's a broken country, Iraq. It's suffered wave after wave of horrible violence, the last of which was this ISIS war. So Muqtada has already positioned himself as the speaker for the dispossessed. And people are very thirsty for that kind of hope. But he has certainly been part of some of the worst corruption in the recent past, as well as some of the worst violence. So like many Iraqis, I have trouble fully believing the reinvention. I think it'll probably end up being more symbolic than real. I have trouble imagining that this man will actually tear down the kind of corrupt spoil system that has actually done quite a bit to help him and his followers in the past.
With all the interconnections and entanglements in the Mideast, what would he mean for Iraq's relationship with other countries in the region, do you think?
He's taken a very balanced position in terms of wanting to move Iraq out of the orbit of Iran. He visited Saudi Arabia. He got a lot of flack for this, but he has said, we want to be friends with everybody, but nobody's tool. And that is actually a very significant development. Similarly, his anti-Americanism helps a lot because he's actually in favor of limited cooperation with the United States on security. And so he's in a position better than I think any of the other leading politicians to genuinely cloak Iraq in some kind of independence. And that's really key to long-term stability, because as long as foreign powers, including Iran and the United States, feel like they can act with impunity inside Iraq, Iraq is going to be unstable and dangerous.
Journalist Thanasi Kambanis, he's also a fellow at the Century Foundation in Beirut. Good to speak with you again, Thanasi. Thank you.
Great to talk to you, Marco.
Just ahead, fighting for LGBT rights in Costa Rica all the way to the presidency. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. If you don't watch Latin American politics, you may have missed the recent drama in Costa Rica. The country has a new president, Carlos Alvarado, after a tumultuous campaign. Alvarado said he wanted to legalize same-sex marriage and expand public health options for transgender people. His opponent, an evangelical singer, ran on an anti-LGBT platform. It was a moment of truth for Costa Rica's LGBT community. Sarah Barrett has this story of one activist.
Vincenzo Bruno posted this selfie video on Facebook in March. He's walking down the street, imploring his followers to vote and condemning the right-wing presidential candidate, Fabricio Alvarado. No more abuse, no more hate. We reject him, he says. Bruno is 44 and lives in the capital, San Jose. There's a reason he sounds so passionate. The battle for LGBT rights has been the battle of his life. Bruno is trans. As a kid, when he was living as a girl, he had 5 locks on his bedroom door.
En mi cuarto tenía unas 4 o 5 llaves.
He'd run home after school and shut himself in his room, making sure to turn every lock. Then he'd look for his makeup pencil. As he tells me this, we're sitting in the home he grew up in.
Y me hacía una barba y un bigote. Me ensanchaba las cejas.
He'd draw on a beard and a mustache, make his eyebrows thicker, and put on his brother's shirt. He'd tie a tie, relax, and watch TV, feeling happy with the way he looked. But when his parents called him to dinner, he'd race to the bathroom, wash off his beard, and put on a blouse like his parents expected. As he grew up, he began to identify as a butch lesbian. He fell in love and had a kid with his girlfriend. And this is when his activism started. He realized his family didn't have the same rights as heterosexual ones.
Empiezo a conocer chicas trans. Me hago vicepresidente de este movimiento de diversidad.
He met a trans woman for the first time when he was working for the LGBT rights movement. She kept prodding him, asking him if maybe he was transgender too. Bruno shot her down every time.
No, yo no soy trans. No, yo no soy trans. No, yo no soy trans.
No, I'm not trans, he remembers telling her.
Una negación, obviamente yo no quería ser ese sujeto.
He saw how people treated her, the insults and looks she had to put up with on a daily basis, and was afraid that being transgender would mean a life of misery. But then one day, he went out shopping with his partner. She had been lightly suggesting that, yeah, maybe he was trans. She brought him to a men's clothing store.
Compramos un pantalón café, compramos un polo shirt, y mi cuerpo entró en shock.
He says they bought brown pants and a polo shirt from the men's section, and he says he went into shock. He left the store, sat down on a bench, and began to cry. He looked at his partner and said, I think I want to be a man. And she looked at him and said, so you finally realized it. What should we do now? Bruno says he thought that there was nothing he could do, but she pushed back. She told him, we're going to find you the right doctor and get hormones.
Fue en el momento donde todo se ilumina. O sea, es como cuando... Yo no sé si ustedes vieron...
All of a sudden, he says, everything seemed illuminated. Have you seen that movie Pleasantville, he asks, where everything is black and white and then all of a sudden it's in color? He says that's how it was for him when he learned he could grow facial hair and transition. He says his life came into color. As his new life took shape, he continued his activism, now fighting explicitly for trans rights. He's one of the first people to win the right to use his new name on his government-issued ID. His transition wasn't easy for his son Luca, then 6 years old.
Ahora en adelante, a mí me gustaría que me apoyaras y quiero ser tu papá en vez de tu mamá. Y se asustó muchísimo.
Bruno explained that he wanted to be called papá now, instead of mamá. That scared Luca. He worried that everything would change and Bruno wouldn't be sweet and caring anymore. That was 5 years ago. At the time, transitioning was a daunting proposition. Costa Rica was a hostile place for someone like Bruno. The first doctor he went to refused to treat him. As Bruno's life evolved, so did Costa Rica's political climate. In 2017, there was a breakthrough. It was the culmination of years of advocacy. The government started offering publicly funded hormone therapy for transgender people. And in another victory for the LGBT community, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruled that Costa Rica should allow same-sex marriage. But then came the backlash. Remember that Facebook message Bruno sent to his followers? He posted that after the first round of presidential elections. He and his fellow activists were shocked when Fabricio Alvarado, the anti-LGBT candidate, prevailed in that first round.
Costa Rica's presidential runoff, a neck-and-neck race that's pitted a ruling party candidate against a conservative evangelical and has been dominated by debate over the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Fabricio Alvarado announced that, if elected, he would break the international treaty and have Costa Rica leave the Inter-American Court of Human Rights rather than follow the ruling and allow same-sex marriage in their country. He promised to can the non-discrimination protections that the outgoing president had signed into law, and he spoke against recognizing transgender people, stoking fears that it would lead to men pretending to be women in order to assault other women. With the runoff election looming, Bruno threw himself into a project he was already committed to, working on a nationwide program to make sure transgender people could make it to the polls without being harassed. But even so, he was worried about the outcome.
La posición que estamos es muy triste, es una posición muy estresante para todos nosotros.
We're in a really sad position, he says. We're in the hands of a completely homophobic and diverse-phobic person. We're all just waiting to see what happens on April 1st.
Costa Ricans set up stalls outside voting stations on Sunday, hoping to win over any remaining undecided voters.
In a strange confluence of events, voting day turned out to be Easter Sunday, and Bruno put on a white shirt with his candidate's name, Carlos Alvarado, in red, and headed out early to vote. It was a long day of anticipation. The whole country had been on vacation and was trying to get back in time to vote. The highways were bumper to bumper, and people filled the overpasses and lined the sides of the roads, waving flags and cheering on their candidate. At the end of the day, Bruno was out in the streets as the results came in.
¡Eso, eso!
¡Eso! Este país acaba de decir, ganar la democracia, ganar la igualdad, ganar...
Democracy won, he says. Equality won. Human rights won. Everybody won.
Costa Rica ganó hoy.
Costa Rica won today. But for Bruno, even with pro-LGBT Carlos Alvarado in power, there's no resting. He is not done yet.
Hay tres cosas que me gustaría. Primero, que no estemos supeditados a un psiquiatra.
He wants Costa Rica to be even more progressive. He wants to be at the forefront of trans-friendly countries. He's pushing the government to start paying for gender-affirming surgery for transgender people, and he wants the program expanded to people under 18. The government says it's open to these changes. Bruno still thinks about his own transition. It's been a few years now. Things are smoother at home and easier with his son Luca.
Hace un día que me vio rasurándome. Entonces me estaba poniendo la espuma a afeitar y me estoy rasurando y de repente
he remembers a day when his son saw him shaving and looked confused. Luca asked if he'd have to do that one day too.
Sí, mi amor, cuando vos te crezca barba también vas a tener que hacerlo.
And he told his son that yes, one day he'd grow a beard and mustache and he'd have to learn to shave too. Bruno remembered that when he was a kid, he thought shaving was the coolest thing in the world. So he covered his young son's face in foam and gave him a plastic shaver, and the two of them took photos to remember one of their first father-son rituals. For The World, Sarah Barrett, San Jose, Costa Rica.
I'm Marco Werman. North Korea's version of the CIA does its share of spying, but it's also a money spinner, making cash through criminal activities, including some sophisticated hacking.
And that doesn't just mean stealing secrets from their rivals. They put a lot of energy and time into robbing banks.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You've heard of the CIA, MI6, the FSB, that's the former KGB, but what do we know about North Korea's intelligence service? I've got The World's Patrick Nguyen here to fill us in. What do we know about North Korea, Patrick?
Well, North Korea's Foreign Intelligence Bureau is called the Cheongche Cheongguk. And just like the CIA, they have had their share of assassinations. They do a lot of spying on their rivals. But the twist is that they have lots of dealings in the underworld. They make a lot of money through essentially organized crime. And those past dealings have involved heroin production, printing counterfeit $100 bills, and even making fake cigarettes.
Yes, so heroin, counterfeit crimes, and also some hacking, too, I hear.
Yeah, not just some hacking. They have amassed some of the most elite hacking units in the world. And that it doesn't just mean stealing secrets from their rivals. They've put a lot of energy and time into robbing banks, hacking banks online, and stealing millions of dollars.
What kind of banks? Like banks here in the United States?
They've hit Citibank. They've hit Wells Fargo. They go after a lot of banks in parts of the world where the banks don't have great security. But they also go after the big guys. They actually pulled a heist involving the New York Federal Reserve, which is one of the most, you know, what we see as one of the most secure banking institutions in the world. And when I found out that they had pulled a heist on the Fed, that really sparked my curiosity and made me want to know, how exactly do these hacking units work? How do they operate? And the pursuit of that story led me to Seoul, South Korea.
That's pretty wild stuff. Let's hear your story.
I'm walking through a slick, polished building in Seoul on my way to see a slick, polished politician. His name is Ha Tae-kyung. Think nice suit, perfect swoosh of black hair. He's a lawmaker working here in South Korea's National Assembly building. And he's a big critic of Kim Jong-un. He's even compared him to Hitler. So it's no surprise that North Korea wants him dead. He was told as much, he says, in a death threat sent in the mail.
4 or 5 years ago, somebody sent me a packet with knife and warning message. If you keep criticizing dear leader, you're going to be killed.
But as it turns out, North Korean agents came up with a better revenge plan, using this politician as the unwitting decoy for a cyber scam. In February, thousands of South Koreans got an email, supposedly sent on Tae-kyung's behalf. It said, "Hey, I'm going to propose this new law to regulate cryptocurrency." Now, this is a really big deal in South Korea, where 1 in 3 salaried workers own cryptocurrency, and any new policy can make prices swing up or down. So to see this new law, you just had to click on a Word file attached to the email. When people would open this email and they clicked on the file, what would happen?
It's contaminated right away. And this computer or this smartphone is not just yours, but also theirs.
Meaning North Korea would have access to all your files, your photos, your passwords, everything they'd need to get into your bank account. Or better yet, your stash of cryptocurrency, which is way harder to get back once it's stolen. I believe you once said cryptocurrency is like Kim Jong-un's safe.
Kim Jong-un's pocket money. There's mafia regime, mafia state. Kim Jong-un, the boss of mafia state.
We still don't know how much North Korea earned from this scam, but it would have tricked even more people if it weren't for a tiny mistake in the email. A single word, offering a clue that it was written by a Korean north of the border. And I will need a Korean speaker to help break this down. This is my co-producer, Sona Jo. Sona, say hi.
Hi.
So what is this word in the email that would look funny to a South Korean? And what does that mean?
It means be careful or warning.
What would you think when you see this word?
It looks really weird because we don't use it anymore and it's unfamiliar to us. It's really like old writing of Korean. Their writing is stuck in the 1950s or 40s.
Do you remember when Kim Jong-un called President Trump a dotard?
Yes, of course.
So for Americans, we had the same reaction. Dotard. What is this, like an ancient word? We had to go look it up. Do you ever have moments like that when you hear North Koreans talking?
Yeah, of course. Especially like, for instance, in case of the dotard. If you translate it directly into Korean, it means old, crazy guy.
What is the word?
늑다리 미치광이.
And would you ever say that in Korean either?
No, it's really old style. We don't use it anymore.
This is what's so fascinating about North Korean hacking. Most people think of North Korea as closed off to the world, this frozen, oppressed place where hardly anyone has even heard of Facebook, a place stuck in the 1950s. But then there's this other North Korea, one that somehow manages to acquire the world's most closely guarded technology, namely hydrogen bombs, the most powerful weapon known to man. So North Korea may be isolated, but its core leaders, they are not technophobes. Just listen to its ruling party, which says technology will be their engine of prosperity.
who sense the technology as the engine. Current scientists and technicians have made lots of excellent scientific and technological achievements in 2017.
They really mean this. When North Korea gets sanctioned for building bombs and loses billions in revenue, it says, fine, you want to kick us out of your global financial system? We'll just hack it and make up the difference. And these hackers are getting good, really good. Take it from this guy.
굳이 이제 그렇게 노력이 안 들어도 충분히 할 수 있는 것들에 대해서는
They're very talented. North Korea has some of the best hackers in the world.
That's Simon Che, 34-year-old tech wizard. When that politician, Tae Gyung, when he first saw that dodgy North Korean email, this is the first person he called. And for good reason. Simon is a consultant for the NIS, South Korea's CIA, and he's obsessed with North Korean hackers. I met up with Simon at his headquarters, inside the offices of a cybersecurity firm called Hauri. He leads me to a glass door, and that's where Simon scans his fingerprints, which unlocks a command center. It's this big room filled with young, very serious-looking programmers. One entire wall is taken up by this glowing map of the world, like you would see at some Pentagon Missile Command Center. I notice parts of the map lighting up with red dots, and Simon tells me, you're seeing cyber attacks happening in real time. So this is sort of a war room, and that's really how Simon sees it. Like he's fighting a cyber war, only instead of combat boots, he wears Buddy Holly glasses and flannel shirts. In South Korea, every male gets drafted into the military. But when Simon was younger, the army told him, hey, you don't need to come to the barracks. Just use your computer skills to keep an eye on North Korean criminals.
3년을 근무를 했습니다. 그래서 3년 동안 근무를 하면서
It was kind of boring, but one day I found a North Korean malware targeting our military, and then I got excited. I started to feel like a soldier, and a soldier has to defend his country. I've been doing this for 10 years.
Simon closely watches this bureau, the Cheongche Cheongguk. Specifically, it's cyber teams with names like Unit 121 and Unit 110. He shows me this amazing document, his life's work. It's a chart showing all the banks North Korea has hacked or tried to hack. Well, at least the ones we know about.
Honestly, I think we've only been able to uncover about 30% of their total hacking. This is just a portion of their activity. I'm trying to uncover more every day.
There are some surprising names here. 4.3 million stolen from Wells Fargo, 9 million from HSBC, and then there's the big one.
Tens of millions of dollars siphoned off from the Federal Bank of New York. Now, apparently,
Kim Jong-un's army of hackers is brazenly attacking banks around the world.
The attackers initiated 35 seemingly legitimate transfers worth $951 million through the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank.
Considered essentially the Rolls Royce of systems, so have to be sharper on the good side. Cyber experts.
By the way, if you're wondering why you missed this, North Korea pulling a heist on the Fed, it happened in February 2016, when election coverage was drowning out pretty much everything. The FBI has actually looked into charging North Korea. And according to a former NSA official, Richard Leggett, a nation-state robbing banks, that is, quote, something different and a big deal. Now, to be clear, North Korea did not steal from the U.S. per se. The Federal Reserve actually holds cash for nations around the world, and this was an account belonging to Bangladesh. The North Koreans hid it, trying to steal almost $1 billion, but once again, they made a spelling error. In their withdrawal request, the hacker said the money was transferring to a charitable foundation, but they spelled it Fandation, F-A-N. A bank employee thought, that's weird, and hit pause on the transfer. That little mistake, it may have cost North Korea $870 million, quite possibly the most expensive typo in history. These spelling mistakes, they feed the idea that North Korean agents, for all their cleverness, are still a bit out of touch. But Simon says, do not underestimate them.
You might think, oh, they're North Korean. They're isolated from the world. But no. They know a lot about technology, the online world. They're not all that different from me.
The detective work of Simon and others shows that the very best hackers get sent out of North Korea to China or India, where the web speeds are much faster. And when they get there, it appears that these hackers are actually given a lot of freedom, at least online.
해커들을 추적을 하면서 한 세 번 정도 그들과 이제 그 온라인에서 채팅으로
I actually succeeded in chatting online with North Korean hackers 3 times. We just talked about IT and coding. You know what? I could tell. These guys are professionals.
Simon feels a complicated emotion towards his rivals. It's respect.
그렇지는 않습니다. 사실 그들도
I don't feel any anger towards them. They have their reasons. That's just North Korea being North Korea.
He says it's almost like he has a connection to them. Like they're dueling snipers, tracking each other's moves across a battlefield made of ones and zeros. But Simon tells me this war is frustrating because his enemy, they get to break all the rules.
적인 측면에서는 아 이런 공격 기술을 실제로 해보지 못하는데 그런 부분들을 자유롭게 하는 것에 대해
Honestly, I feel a little jealous because they have the freedom to do anything they want online. It's very ironic, I know that.
As North Korea's hacker army keeps robbing banks and pulling cryptocurrency scams, Simon will be watching from his war room. And if any North Korean hackers ever want to chat, he says, hey, come find me. You know I'm always online. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Seoul, South Korea.
Patrick also tracked down some North Korean cyber experts who defected and now live in hiding in Seoul. Here's what they told him about hackers back in Pyongyang.
They're the geniuses of North Korea. People say America has the best government hackers. Russia is number 2, China is number 3. But tell me, honestly, is anyone pulling off as many hacking operations as North Korea?
The lives of North Korean hackers, that's tomorrow here on The World. A note now on a story that's been making headlines this week in Germany. It has to do with two very famous soccer players there, Mesut Özil and İlkay Gündoğan. Both have Turkish roots but are German citizens, and both play for Germany's World Cup-winning men's national team. But this week, they're embroiled in a controversy because they pose for pictures with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan is up for re-election next month and would love the votes of Turkish expats in Germany. Problem is, he can't actually campaign there.
Germany banned Turkish politicians to campaign on the German soil following tension between the two countries after the failed coup attempt in July 2016.
That's Seda Cesar Bilen, a journalist with Deutsche Welle's Turkish service in Bonn, Germany. The tension she mentioned is all about the crackdown launched by Erdogan after that attempted coup against him 2 years ago. His government has targeted critics, accusing them of supporting the coup and arresting thousands of them. Erdogan has also shut down media outlets and fired government employees. So for many, in Germany, Turkey, and elsewhere, those two soccer players posing with Erdogan amounted to an endorsement of the crackdown. Seda Cesar Bilen says there was a lot of negative reaction in Germany to the pictures.
In the German press, it's been widely discussed, and they couldn't make their decision whether that was pure stupidity or they lack political judgment. These guys were seen as examples of successful integration in Germany, and that's why people are so upset here, especially the politicians from all the factions and parties. Everybody is very upset because they are examples for people with Turkish background, and they've been always pointed as successful integration examples. And now, you know, German press also says that they didn't do any good for Germany because they are now, you know, used as campaign material for President Erdogan, which Germany sees as, you know, violating democratic rights. Following the backlash, those players said that they didn't really intend to make a political statement with their photos and that they are committed to the values of the German Football Federation, but the damage was done already.
Now some Germans are even questioning whether Mesut Özil and İlkay Gündoğan should play for Germany's national team again. A commentary in the newspaper Bild argued that, yes, they should. They are political idiots, the author wrote, but soccer geniuses. Employees at the Kellogg's breakfast cereal plant in Venezuela got a rude awakening yesterday. When they got to work, they found a notice on the door saying the factory was closed. No explanation, no prior warning, nothing. The company later blamed the economic and social deterioration of the country, but didn't provide any other details. Kellogg is just the latest multinational to pick up and leave Venezuela in the face of currency controls, price controls, and hyperinflation. Cajal Villas is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Caracas. So give us a sense of how big a deal this is economically for Venezuela. Like, how important is Kellogg there? What are their major brands?
Well, cornflakes and a brand called Sucaritas, which is basically like Frosted Flakes with Tony the Tiger on it. They made about 3/4 of the country's breakfast cereals. And Venezuela's been for many years a very consumerist culture. They are big fans of U.S. brands. And so seeing Kellogg pull out of the country is another reminder of the extreme economic downfall that the country is going through. And it's also a reminder of the food shortages that are very rampant in Venezuela due to these economic problems.
Yeah, so can most Venezuelans in times of rampant inflation even afford breakfast cereal?
Less and less so. People have trouble affording really anything these days. You talk to people on the streets, and basically the main conversation for anybody is how they can't afford the meats that they used to buy, the corn flour that they used to buy, and breakfast cereals have almost become a luxury for many people. These are goods that Venezuelans have consumed for many years. Kids, same as back in the States, eat them most mornings. They were accustomed to enjoying these goods and can no longer find them.
I mean, it's not funny, especially when people are dumpster diving for food in Caracas, but I mean, all the cereal mascots and cartoon animals kind of make this rich for satire. I saw one meme of Tony the Tiger waiting in line to cross the border into Colombia, which is a path, as you know, many Venezuelans have had to take to escape poverty and misery in their country. What memes have you been seeing?
I did see that one. Tony the Tiger has appeared in several of these. Another one where he's just kind of disintegrating. It kind of almost looks like cereal falling. There's been a host of them. Yeah, you've seen kind of a lot of very dark humor, which is very indicative of the times that the country is living.
What do you think the humor around this is about?
People joke about these things because, I mean, what else can one do? And for so many Venezuelans, they hear President Maduro talking about how they're going to replace Kellogg, same way they had said that they were going to replace General Motors and Ford and the dozens of airlines that have left the country, and they don't really quite have much luck with it. And so there's a real sense of cynicism and sarcasm when they hear promises by the government that they're going to maintain the operations of Kellogg without Kellogg.
Yeah. So what's been the reaction from President Nicolas Maduro to the Kellogg decision?
He has basically said exactly what he has said when most major companies have left the country. He's called it, you know, basically part of a big international conspiracy, a capitalist conspiracy to tumble his government. And he also promised that, you know, they were going to turn over the Kellogg plant over to the workers. Now, they did the same when Clorox left about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, what does that
and
even mean?
It means that the labor ministry here will oversee operations, and the same workers are going to keep the factory running. That's the broad idea. The point is it has never worked, and production has, you know, dropped basically to the floor. And it's a major reason why so many of the supermarket shelves are bare these days. They have not been able to replace these companies that produced all the consumer goods that Venezuelans enjoy.
Cajal Villas, the Wall Street Journal's reporter on the ground in Caracas. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tony the Tiger escaping Venezuela. That's surreal. I've been saying surreal a lot lately. Things are chaotic, uncertain, often terrifying, yet hysterical, all at the same time. Yeah, surreal.
Every day there is such a motherload of, I don't know how else to say it, surreal news.
Surreality. It's a surreal feeling that we live in now.
Don't you think it's kind of surreal that we are in a place now as a country where we're like, oh, don't listen to the president like he's a crazy person on a park bench with an onion tied to his belt just mumbling incoherently?
An onion tied to his belt? I mean, that's a scene that 90-year-old surrealist painter Desmond Morris could have painted. He's just published a book called The Lives of Surrealists, and Morris was more than happy to assess our current state of surrealism.
Some people say that the world today is becoming increasingly surreal. It's used just to mean a strange event. I had a surreal event.
Trump aide Kellyanne Conway is now apologizing for referring to a massacre in Bowling Green that never happened.
Strangely, the 21st century has become almost more surreal than the 20th. I think the surrealists would enjoy today because there are so many really strange characters now involved in international life. And the world has become used to expecting shocks and surprises.
I will be the greatest jobs president that God ever created. I tell you that.
I think a lot of people, when looking at political leaders today, see some of them as being slightly surrealist in their approach to life. President Trump is full of surprises. He doesn't go by the usual rules of the Washington elite. And I think a meeting between North Korea and North America would be certainly a surrealist occasion.
Your people yearn to set eyes on their beloved Kim Jong-un. Please, some are wondering if you're still in charge.
Fools! I am the one and only shining sun.
Surrealism is still very much alive. It's in advertising, it's in cinema, it's in writing. And the essence of surrealism, of course, is using the unconscious to be inventive and creative. Not being analytical, not trying to represent the outside world, but to somehow or other portray in art the essence of the outside world, but influenced by unconscious thoughts, irrational thoughts that spring up out of the mind. Magritte, who's very famous, of course, for taking real objects and putting them in an unreal relationship so that a man has a face which is a green apple. Instead of a head, he's got a green apple on his neck. And this is totally irrational. We love novelty. We love new things. And that is something which I think surrealism, it's been a powerful influence in that respect.
Desmond Morris, surrealist painter and author of the new book, The Lives of Surrealists. And if the name Desmond Morris sounds familiar, he's also a well-known zoologist with a long career on the BBC. To riff on Magritte, ceci n'est pas une pipe. I know that doesn't make any sense, but with surrealism, you could say anything and pretend it makes sense. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. See you in the Daffodil Garden.
PRI, Public Radio International.